Hello and welcome to Dive and Dig, the podcast that takes you on a remarkable underwater journey to reveal mysteries of our shared pasts beneath the waves.
When you're young, you read Tintin books and you see pictures of shipwrecks and stuff like that. And then you grow up and you think, well, yeah, obviously shipwrecks aren't really like that at all. Actually, they can be better.
I'm Bethany Hughes, and this is the Dive and Dig podcast. With me is Lucy Blue.
Hello, Bethany.
Hello, Lucy. Now, we've been working with a maritime archaeologist in Malta, Dr. Timmy Gambin, who's excavating a Phoenician shipwreck.
Today, we're also going to explore what happens in the process of a ship going down, when a ship wrecks, what happens to it. And firstly, we're going to actually hear from Honor Frost. Honor Frost was a pioneer maritime archaeologist who explored many areas of the Eastern Mediterranean on the coastline and underwater. And this is how she describes the process of shipwrecking.
Wrecks don't just arrive on the bottom upright and remain like that for a couple of millennia. They're just like temples on land. They fall down and they become buried, but in a rather different way. And in order to excavate them properly, you've got to know how a wreck forms.
So to further understand this process of shipwrecking, I'm going to talk to my colleague, Dr. Stella Domestica. She's a leading maritime archaeologist based in the University of Cyprus.
Yes, when ships go down, well, that's that's a moment, you know, we have to remember that shipwrecks are accidents. Suddenly, for different reasons, it's lost. So depending what kind of ship we're talking about, what kind of place we are, if it's the weather, if it's a fire, if it's another technical problem that causes the accident, there are certain steps and certain activities that the crew or the passengers or the people, anyone on board, would do to prevent it from happening. So this is already part of the wrecking process. And then another random factor is the seabed. What kind of seabed the ship will reach if it happens to wreck on a rocky, sloppy seabed, it will be totally different. It will become a totally different site than if it rests on a flat, sandy seabed. And this is where the Mazotos shipwreck, the one I'm excavating, lies, on a sandy, flat seabed. And this was very important for its good preservation, because instead of dispersing, instead of having a scattered assemblage of what remains of the shipwreck, now we have a coherent, as we say, a coherent site, which is half buried in the sand. Some disturbing must have happened from the sea life that was attracted by the shipwreck, because shipwrecks like these are like artificial reefs, so they attract a lot of sea life. We have seen, for example, how a turtle, or two or three of them that are living in our shipwreck, are moving things around because they are eating or they are pushing, so they are moving and changing our stratigraphy, so to speak. So there are all these factors that we can imagine happening. Apart from this, we have a site which have kept its main stratigraphic units undisturbed. So we can, with careful excavation, we can try and reconstruct this lost internal space of the ship.
Lucy, how do archaeologists and their teams reverse or at least stabilise the various effects suffered by ships and their contents while they're underwater? Well, actually, or for that matter, on land?
That's a really good question. Because essentially, if you think of an ancient shipwreck, it's a wooden hull with many organic cargoes. And organics do not survive well underwater unless they're buried. And basically, they need to be buried and sealed so that the oxygen can't get to them. And if that's the case, then we have remarkable preservation of organic materials. Honor herself, when she was part of a team excavating the late Bronze Age shipwreck off Cape Caledonia in Turkey, this was one of the first shipwrecks ever to be excavated systematically, describes that whole process of how different materials are conserved underwater, how they survive or not, as the case may be. And this is a short extract from her book, Under the Mediterranean.
Except for the surface layer, each part of the pile of metal cargo which had fallen on rock had at some period been half buried by the ever-mounting sand, which had originally gathered as a result of the wreck itself. At some point, therefore, each piece of metal was receiving less oxygen in the part below the sand than in the part that was surrounded by water. It was the action set up by this difference of environment that might have caused the form of decay we found. Here was another indication that the technical aspects of underwater excavation, until they became better understood, required the attention of a great many different kinds of experts.
Basically, when we're excavating a shipwreck, we're disturbing it. We're disturbing that natural environment it's been in for the last however many years. So conservation is critical. And I'm certainly no expert in conservation processes. You really need to be a scientist to understand these. And now I'm going to talk to Cathy Giagrandi, as she is one of the leading experts in marine conservation.
When a ship goes down, it goes into a kind of soup of various sort of processes, including sort of chemical processes and biological ones. And if they're very exposed, physical processes can really do a lot of damage, as can things like woodworm and marine burrows and fungicides and bacteria and all kinds of things can attack ships. So the deterioration is really very different depending on the conditions.
So if you're lucky enough for the hull to get buried under the sediments and therefore the, you know, oxygen attack, as it were, is reduced, what happens after that? I mean, how do we get a shipwreck that's reasonably well preserved on the seabed? How do we lift it and make sure that it remains preserved once it's out of the water?
Well, a conservator's job, if you're a diving conservator, you get to go down and sometimes assist with the lifting process, because that's very important too. It has to be lifted in the right way in order to preserve whatever you're lifting. But even if you're not, things come up out of the water, and of course, right away, oxygen attacks it. So take wood, for example. Wood is made from lignin and also cellulose. Well, the fiber of wood tends to not react so much or deteriorate underwater as much as the cellulose does. The cellulose is the sort of tubes of a wood structure. If you think about like a natural sponge, it gives you a very good idea what happens to wood when it comes out of the water. So a natural sponge has lots of holes in it. Those are the sort of cells of a piece of wood. It comes up out of the water. And if you don't replace that water that's holding those cells up with something, then you have something called shrinkage. And just like a sponge does, it shrinks and it contorts and it takes on these weird shapes.
Yeah, so it's basically drying out, in effect, then, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's wood and presumably other organics are affected in a similar manner.
Yeah, absolutely. Leather, bone, that's another thing. I mean, and the other thing is you need to get the salt out, because salt is very detrimental to most things, including ceramics. And that has to be done very slowly, because if it's done too quickly, you can cause other problems. Bits of ceramic can sort of pop off. You see that a lot with glass. Glass comes up out of the sea, and if it's desalinated, that's the technical term, too quickly, meaning you put it in too much fresh water too quickly, you have to do it in incremental steps, then you get some sort of almost like a shedding happening to the body of the glass. I know, it's kind of well, conservation is very much like, you're really a doctor in a way. You're having to be, first evaluate what the conditions which the ship or the artifacts have been in, and then once they come out, you have to think about the best way to conserve them.
Because all of these different objects and the ship itself and maybe even rigging or whatever, I mean, they're all made of different materials. So presumably they have different, you have to adopt different approaches to different objects.
Yes, absolutely. For wood, for instance, I mean, the thing that you use sometimes, and we have used in the past to replace it, is polyethylene glycol, or it's known sort of by its short name, PEG, P-E-G. And it's been used in the food and cosmetic industries first, but then it was adopted by the conservators because what does it do? It's a petroleum-based substance and it enters the cells of the wall. So as the water disappears, it replaces the water and it can hold up the cell structure. And so we started using that. People used it, I think, way back in the 60s it started. Anna, of course, was one of the pioneers in using it on the Marsala wreck. And as we saw on that wreck, it's been quite successful.
Lucy, I know other famous ships that have been conserved using PEG, or PEG, as it should be called probably, but in time, and if the environment isn't ideal, the timbers do start to degrade. So how do you record timbers and other artefacts to secure the knowledge they hold, particularly when we're just unable to conserve them?
Again, quite remarkably, Anna Frost also thought about some of these long-term issues. So 50 years ago, when she was working on a shipwreck from off the coast of Sicily, Marsala, she used, in those early days, PEG, polyethylene glycol, to conserve the timbers. But she also took plaster casts of the timbers. So it was a direct record of the timbers as she'd lifted them off the seabed. So she had this sort of double approach. One was to record the timbers as they were lifting, the other was to conserve them. But nowadays, we also employ other techniques, such as laser scanning, sometimes photogrammetry, but laser scanning, particularly in a stable environment, can be a really good way of documenting not just the ship timbers, the ship hull, but also finds very rapidly and very accurately. And a colleague of mine from the foundation, from the Anna Frost Foundation, is here to tell us a little bit more about the sort of next stage of Anna's work with the Marsala ship, laser scanning the timbers. Lauren, great to have you on board. We've just heard Kathy talking about the PEG conservation methodology, and we know that all those years ago, 50 years ago, when Anna Frost was working on the Marsala, she lifted the vessel and she used those very same technologies to conserve the timbers. But since then, the boat's been on display in the museum, in Marsala, and lots of other things have been happening. And I know that there's been some recent developments with the documentation of the boat. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, that's right. So quite recently, there was a project to document the ship remains using photogrammetry, as well as high-resolution 3D laser scanning. The reason that the team did that, it was to produce a digital archive of the ship. So that could help with future conservation strategies, and also to give us a better understanding of the integrity of the site. So, as you said, it's been 50 years since the vessel was lifted, and then it was preserved using the PEG treatment. But what the laser scanning allowed the team to do was to help to preserve the timbers by record. So it's a digital archive that they were creating of the timbers that they could also then use to inform future conservation strategies, so they could see how to deal with the timbers going forward as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. And we've heard a lot about photogrammetry, but very little about laser scanning. What's involved with that technology?
Yes, so laser scanning is essentially the use of a laser to capture 3D spatial data. This is in the form of a point cloud. It captures many points at varying distances that can then be processed and used in a variety of 2 and 3D software. It's more accurate than photogrammetry, and it's useful in sites where access can be difficult. So what we're seeing is that laser scanning and photogrammetry have become useful tools in creating a digital record of archaeological remains. In some cases, for sites that can't be excavated or they're at risk of being lost, these techniques are used to essentially preserve them by record. So we're seeing these methods really increasingly being used in maritime archaeology now.
Yes, and of course, the other thing that the team that are re-documenting the Marsala shipwreck are doing is they're trying to sort of generate or use that data to promote and present the sort of discoveries of Marsala to a broader audience. And in the process of doing that, they're creating a virtual exhibition using CGI or computer-generated imagery to allow you and I to do a virtual dive on the wreck. And in order to learn a little bit more about the technology, this computer-generated imagery, we're going to talk to Grant Cox. Grant's the mastermind behind generating this virtual dive, and we're going to be able to eventually explore the Marsala wreck just as Honor would have seen it herself.
So for the virtual dive itself, I started with the plans and illustrations of the timbers that were found, and focused on trying to recreate those to begin with. And that gave me an idea of the site, almost like fixing jigsaw pieces back together again. Basically, kind of wrapping paper for the models that were then applied to give it a sense of context. And then from that, we built outwards. We created the landscape from, again, drawings, illustrations, and started to fill in the blanks. And really, the model is a thinking platform for us to build on in the future.
Lucy, as well as the ship's timbers, what else did Honor find on the Marsala Punic ship?
Well, she didn't find a massive amount of cargo, but she did find some intriguing things. One of them, or some of them, were a number of baskets. And these baskets were filled with a plant-like remains, and she didn't really know what they were. So she turned to Kew Gardens, the Jodrell Laboratories in Kew Gardens, to find out more, with some quite surprising results.
The wreck took 4 years to excavate. And on the first year, I saw among the food a great many little yellow, what looked like stems of grass. And so I picked them up and put them into little plastic containers and took them back with the samples to Kew. But we were getting so many samples of plants that Kew simply did what they could, and a lot didn't get analysed. And so on the second or third year, I was determined. I found a basket of these things. And the identification came out as Cannabis sativa.
So they've been chewing pot?
Chewing it, because you see, the best pot is made from the upper leaves and the small leaves and pollen. They may have made tea out of it, it's quite possible, out of the lower part that doesn't have so much drug in it.
And do you think that kept them going as they were rowing?
Oh, yes.
That is the most brilliant thing I've heard. So no way, weed, tea-drinking rowers from Phoenician times. But actually, you know, it makes sense because you hear a lot about these kind of fortified honey cakes that rowers were often given to go into battle. So, you know, and that was pretty plentiful. So that has changed my perception, Lucy, of those Phoenician ships.
Yes, the fortifications that we need in order to keep rowing, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, but brilliant that, again, Honor spotted there was something special. And there is one particular project that is currently exciting great archaeological interest. It's a shipwreck off Gozo, near Malta. The research team, led by Dr. Timmy Gambin of the University of Malta, are pushing the limits of diving to reach the site so they can explore the remains of the wreck. And they are making some remarkable discoveries.
The ceramic objects have multiple stories to tell. Thin sections tell us where the clay was harvested from and where the amphoras were made. Now, what is also of interest to us and to other researchers is what were these amphoras carrying. And in order to understand that, we need to look inside the amphoras. One of the telltale signs of what it could be carrying is whether the amphoras are lined with pitch or not. If the amphoras have a black coating, the black coating is generally pitch, and amphoras that are coated in pitch were generally carrying wine. The inside, the ceramic, would be lined so that the wine would not take on sort of a undesirable taste by coming into contact with the clay. The other way to find out what was being carried inside these ceramic containers is to do lipid analysis.
To tell us more, we have Dr. Cynthia Ann Spiteri, Professor of Archaeometry, who's been analysing lipids from Timmy's Phoenician amphora and will tell us what secrets they might reveal.
Well, lipids are a diverse group of compounds, really, and they include oils and fats. So this technique works on the premise that in ancient times, people were cooking in ceramics. Ceramics are quite porous, and lipids would have become absorbed inside the ceramic during use. And this is what we target then for our analysis. And we target lipids because they are very strong biomolecules that tend to survive over very long periods of time. And this is because they are very strong molecules. They have a very strong structure. They're also hydrophobic, and they are quite resistant to heat. And the testing really involves the extraction of the lipids. So as we were saying before, lipids are hydrophobic, so we can't use anything water-based. So the reagent that we use is organic. So organic dissolves in organic. And we have quite a few different extraction protocols that we use, depending on the lipid molecules that we are targeting. Some lipids bind more tightly than others to the ceramic matrix, and this is why we have different extraction protocols. So these are amphorae, which were found on a 7th century BC shipwreck off the coast of Gozo on the archipelago of Malta. And what we are trying to find out is the content of these vessels. So by looking at the lipids that were absorbed within the ceramic matrix, we are trying to reconstruct what their content was. And this could be something in the range of oils or animal fats or perhaps even wine. And because so far we don't know really the ship was actually coming into Malta or going away from it, we as yet don't know whether these products perhaps were being imported into Malta or exported out of Malta. And by combining content analysis together with other techniques which are being applied also to study these amphorae, so for example, pedrography, we hope to also find the origin where these amphorae were constructed to hopefully shed a bit more light also on where these contents were being produced.
Well, that's really interesting. And actually, the analysis of finds from the Phoenician shipwreck is revealing so much about the cargo and life on board. So I'm going to talk now to a forensic archaeologist, Roland Wessling, and he's going to tell us more about isotopic analysis.
Isotopes are basically modifications of atoms, and they happen to all atoms, so whether or not it's oxygen or nitrogen or any other atom, and they exist in certain percentages. And depending on where you are in the world, these percentages will vary. So if we have a chance to analyze the percentage of an isotope to its normal atom and its proportion, we can not pinpoint where someone has been, but we can draw conclusions what region someone may have been. This to a journey of a ship that was, you know, shipwrecked basically, let's say, off the coast of Malta. You know, first question would be, well, where have they been last? Where have they come from? And before that, where they have come from, you know, maybe there's a chance to actually find out whether or not this ship was on a particular route back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, or whether or not it did tours around the Mediterranean, or who knows. So isotope analysis is a wonderful tool to actually give us information about a particular individual and their everything from their teens all the way to the moment they died.
What about things like what they're eating or the diet-related things?
You can draw conclusions from certain isotopes, whether or not someone was basically living more of a plant-based diet or a fish-based diet or a meat-based diet. So you can definitely draw some conclusions on that.
It is amazing, isn't it, Lucy, what science can help explain? I mean, even if you've just got a single boat, you can work out what routes it sailed, what was found on board. You can kind of jigsaw puzzle together the story. But what happens when you just have a simple seashell? What can you learn then?
So we're going to hear now from Professor David Aboulafia from the University of Cambridge. He's a professor in Mediterranean history, and he's going to tell us more about the history of the Phoenicians.
The particular product that fascinates me is murex, the shells, well, not the shells, the contents of these mollusks, which produced a very rich dye, which varied enormously in colour. I mean, there were different ways of sort of processing it. So you just had to, you could leave it out in the sun longer and it would turn this colour or that colour, whatever. But by and large, something between purple and a sort of orangey red. So purple, which was, you know, the colour very much associated with royalty from remote antiquity, that was clearly in great demand at princely courts. So their search, not just along the coasts of the Levant, but deeper and deeper into the Mediterranean, then beyond the Mediterranean, even as far as Mogador, Essaouira, on the coast of Morocco. Is that 600 kilometres or something down the coast of Morocco to an island there where they were able to collect these shells?
Amazing, that purple production, because I know that the purple dye that was produced was worth more than gold, and right the way back from the Bronze Age. Is it on those early Greek Linear B tablets? I think the colour is called Wanax Purpura, which is, you know, the purple of kings. You know, it had this real kind of royal association with it. I just love it. Although, I have to say, I've been to a reconstruction of a murex kind of industry plant, so where the purple dye was extracted, and you use urine and there's kind of rotting sea snails. It smells absolutely disgusting, even if it ends up with something rather beautiful.
Yes, no, they always located them downwind of the settlements.
That's right. And Timmy Gammon's going to join us again from Malta, where he's working on that Phoenician shipwreck. Timmy, I think you have found some shells on board your wreck, but you haven't had them analysed yet. How likely is it that you're going to have murex on that boat?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, really, because we know that the Phoenicians were renowned for their purple dye, for which they needed murex shells. We have some shells that look like that look very similar to murex shells, but remember that these have been in an underwater context for 2,700 years, so they've been somewhat rounded, etc. We're currently having them analysed. I don't want to put my head on the block, but if they are murex, this would be an amazing discovery.
Amazing. Genuinely exciting. Any other recent discoveries?
When we recover the amphorae, we sieve the sediments that they contain. They're packed nearly to the top, to the very top, with thick sediment, which is great because whatever is inside or whatever is caught inside is preserved, because the sediment creates anaerobic conditions, meaning no oxygen, meaning no decomposition of organic objects. And during one of the recent sieving sessions, we came across a bone, a small rib, possibly of a lamb or a baby goat, not dissimilar to what is being excavated on terrestrial sites in Sardinia. So again, we're looking at tastes related to food consumption.
Just explain the thing with the bone. So they're being transported, and what is that? Kind of like a jugged hare or something. So they're being butchered and then transported in the amphorae as fresh meat or cured meat? What do you think?
This is an extremely recent discovery, and these are all very exciting questions that we hope to answer through analysis of this bone. One of the things we're going to look at is DNA. Is it a type of sheep or goat that is brought from the Eastern Mediterranean, for example? We're collaborating with an institution in France to explore these possibilities. Then we can see whether there are any chemical traces of flavors that would have been used to cure the meat, and therefore we can say, yes, the meat was cured. So this is the beauty of archaeology, and more specifically the beauty of maritime archaeology, whereby a small find or a seemingly small find like a bone all of a sudden opens up a number of doors that lead to other research questions and other possible discoveries.
How brilliant. Keep us posted, please.
I will do.
Wonderful. In the next episode, we'll conclude our journey, revealing the developments in maritime archaeology today and discovering how climate change has impacted both past and future. We'll also study the cargo of the Phoenician shipwreck to map trade and long-distance exchange. And we'll be discovering how the Phoenicians were not only exceptional harbour builders, but master seafarers and long-distance traders. According to Herodotus, they even circumnavigated Africa. Was that really possible over 2,000 years ago? This Dive and Dig podcast was brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charitable foundation supporting maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. Thank you so much for listening again. Bye.
Bye.